Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your host, Diana, here with you every Saturday to bring you the news and top stories from the Military Times, your independent news source about your military. Starting with the latest headlines, Army veteran tasked with prosecuting Nazi death squads awarded Congressional Gold Medal. Congress, on Tuesday, posthumously awarded American prosecutor Benjamin Ferencz with a Congressional Gold Medal, the highest U.S. honor bestowed on civilians for his work taking on Nazi death squads during the Nuremberg trials. Ferencz, who died in 2023 at the age of 103, was just 27 with no previous trial experience when he became chief prosecutor in one of the most significant murder trials in history. While Congress voted to bestow the medal to Ferencz in 2022, his family members were on hand to posthumously receive the honor this week during the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's annual Days of Remembrance commemoration at the U.S. Capitol. Mr. Ferencz was a tremendous force for good, a fierce New Yorker with a heart of gold and a backbone of steel, a man who saw the worst of humanity and spent the better part of a century fighting for the best of it, said Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, during the ceremony. He came face to face with evil, recalling the fact that he had, quote, peered into hell. Gillibrand continued, a lesser person might have looked away, but Ben Ferencz looked harder. Born in Transylvania in 1920, Ferencz, who was the last surviving prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials, immigrated with his family to the United States when he was an infant to escape anti-Jewish pogroms. After graduating from Harvard Law School in 1943, Ferencz enlisted in the U.S. Army and was given the job of anti-aircraft artillery gunner. In their typical Army brilliance, being a Harvard Law School graduate and an expert on war crimes, they assigned me to clean the latrines in the artillery and do every other filthy thing they could give me. Ferencz reminisced about the Army's odd job placement in a 2016 interview with the Washington Post. The outspoken Ferencz, who barely registered over 5 feet tall, eventually rose to the rank of a sergeant as a member of General George Patton's Third Army. Action during the Normandy invasion followed, as did breaking through the Maginot and Siegfried lines, crossing the Rhine, and bitter fighting in the Battle of the Bulge. After Ferencz's honorable discharge in 1945, General Telford Taylor, then the chief prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials, recruited Ferencz to return to Germany and work with a team of investigators tasked with uncovering the horrors of the Nazi regime. Tasked with gathering credible evidence of Nazi war crimes for the Army's War Crimes Branch, Ferencz encountered the depths of human depravity. The Germans maintained meticulous death registries at the camps of Buchenwald, Mauthausen, Flossenbürg, and Ebensee. These registries, which Ferencz was ordered to collect, contained the names of millions of victims. "When I passed the figure of 1 million, I stopped adding," he recalled in an interview with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. "That was quite enough for me." It was there that Ferencz and his colleagues discovered the dossiers of the Nazi mobile death squads, the Einsatzgruppen, roving extermination squads that targeted Jews, Roma, homosexuals, and political dissidents in Eastern Europe. In the subsequent trial, the International Military Tribunal determined that nearly 2 million Jews were murdered by the Einsatzgruppen. "Death was their tool and life their toy," Ferencz told the judge during the opening statement of United States of America versus Otto Ollendorf et al. "If these men be immune, then law has lost its meaning and man must live in fear." All 22 men prosecuted by Ferencz were convicted. Most were sentenced to death. All right, that was an article from the military history section of the Military Times. Up next, an opinion article written by the executive director of the nonprofit Secure Families Initiative and the spouse of an active duty service member currently stationed overseas. What follows is effectively an open letter to the civilian leadership of the military. How chest-thumping rhetoric erodes service member safety. Over the Easter weekend, Americans waited anxiously for news about the two U.S. aircrew members whose plane was downed in Iran. When the media finally reported they had been brought to safety, many breathed a collective sigh of relief, and our attention quickly zeroed in on the cinematic details of the daring rescue operation. But there's a layer to this story that we need to unpack before the news cycle moves on, because this rescue mission carried extra desperation, extra urgency. Our downed service members were in even more danger than they needed to be, and it's all because America's topmost military leadership made it that way. I'm the spouse of an active duty service member leading a nonpartisan organization of military family members stationed all across the globe. Our community comprises families from all different branches, ranks, and backgrounds, including, most relevant to this story, the family members of aviators. Many pilots and aircrew members carry something on their person called a blood chit. It's a panel stitched to the inside of their flight jacket, translated into multiple languages. Here's what it says. I'm an American. I do not speak your language. Misfortune forces me to seek your assistance. Please take me to someone who will provide for my safety and see that I am returned to my people. Rules of engagement exist in war for a reason. They minimize harm to the unarmed. They ensure baseline humanity in what is otherwise a tragic fog of violence. They're not rules we unilaterally abide by just to be nice. They're rules we rely on in return. When a pilot deploys on a mission and their spouse or child hugs them goodbye, this panel serves as a literal physical reminder of the international norms meant to bring our service member home safely. It's a promise we can feel. When Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth indulges in brash, chest-thumping rhetoric, like saying our military will provide no quarter, no mercy to unarmed surrenders, it's morally wrong and frankly embarrassing for all the reasons many pundits have already said. It is also profoundly destabilizing for actively serving military families, because the military is an inherently dangerous job. Our military's leadership is supposed to look out for the well-being of our service members, minimizing as much unnecessary risk to their safety as possible. Yet now, our leaders are doing the exact opposite, eroding the very foundations that safety is built upon. Physical injury is not our only concern either. Service members also encounter high risks of moral injury when the missions they're sent to carry out are ambiguous or unjust, and when the actions they're called to carry out diverge from what we know as right and decent. Some injuries like these may take years to surface, but as family members of those who serve, we're always the ones who end up shouldering the caretaking responsibility when they do. We only call wars endless or forever if the fighting lasts longer than the public can stomach, but every war is a forever war for the families they impact. One of the first details we learned from photos of the plane's wreckage was that it had flown out of RAF Leckenheath in the United Kingdom. My family is currently stationed down the country road from that installation. While every military family knows what it's like to see themselves reflected in news around war, that was especially true for my local community here. It is imperative that our military's highest civilian leaders restore our family's confidence that rules of engagement will be honored by those who wear the uniform. Our loved one's safety depends on it. Once again, that was an opinion article by Sarah Strider, executive director of the nonprofit Secure Families Initiative, and the spouse of an active duty service member currently stationed overseas. I just want to add, as a former service member myself, that I have a lot of respect for those civilians and family members overseas and at home who fight in their own ways on behalf of those who serve or have served. Now let's move on to one of the latest top stories. Combat Search and Rescue's Uncertain Future. As A-10s phase out, U.S. Air Force faces questions of what comes next. The call sign Sandy, used by U.S. Air Force aircraft and pilots conducting combat search and rescue operations, traces to late 1965. Captain J.W. Doc George, a U.S. Air Force A-1 Sky Raider pilot, arrived at Udorn Royal Thai Air Force Base, Thailand, as part of a SESAR replacement rotation from Bien Hoa, South Vietnam. When asked what call sign his flight would use, he suggested the one he used at Bien Hoa, Sandy. The name stuck. It was passed to his replacement and soon became the standard call sign for all A-1 Sky Raiders flying SESAR missions protecting downed air crews. The Sandy role was later transferred to the faster LTV A-7D Corsair II in 1972 as the last Sky Raiders were withdrawn from Southeast Asia. However, the A-7 struggled in the role due to its higher maneuvering speeds, which made it less effective for low and slow visual searches and close helicopter escort than the A-1. In the late 70s, the Corsair passed the SESAR baton to the A-10 Thunderbolt II Warthog, which offered excellent loiter time, survivability, and firepower suited to the mission. The A-10 airframe and its pilots still carry the Sandy call sign today. As the Air Force accelerates plans to retire the A-10 Thunderbolt II by fiscal year 2029, the service faces a growing set of unanswered questions about what replaces it in combat search and rescue, one of the military's most specialized mission sets. More than an analysis of replacement aircraft and their capabilities, the transition raises concerns about the pilots in the cockpit who for nearly five decades have received specialized training in the combat search and rescue mission and built trust within the SESAR community, with congressional oversight and legislation underscoring concerns about SESAR operational readiness and on the heels of a SESAR mission over Iran that brought two F-15E airmen home. The stakes of those unanswered questions have taken on a new sense of urgency. Highly skilled Sandy pilots. In the past several decades, A-10s have assumed the Sandy role in SESAR operations in the Gulf War, Iraq, and Afghanistan, Kosovo, and most recently in the April 3, 2026 operation that recovered two American F-15E Strike Eagle airmen from Iranian territory. One supporting A-10 sustained heavy battle damage during the mission. Its pilot continued flying long enough to eject safely over Kuwait. During an April 6, 2026 press conference detailing that mission, General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, described the role of a Sandy. A Sandy has one mission, to get to the survivor, bring the rescue force forward, and put themselves between that survivor on the ground and the enemy. Kane said, "They are committed to this. This is what they live for, and this is what they've trained for many, many years." Only the most experienced A-10 pilots are selected for Sandy qualification, which requires specialized training in SESAR tactics and procedures as part of a full SESAR task force, including HC-130 tankers and HH-60 helicopters. This advanced training takes place primarily at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, Arizona, home of the 357th Fighter Squadron, the Air Force's formal A-10 training unit. Here, Sandy pilots participate in integrated exercises, local ranges, and large-scale events like Angel Thunder, the Air Force's largest and most comprehensive SESAR exercise. Additional operational integration takes place at Moody Air Force Base, Georgia. In a typical four-ship A-10 Sandy SESAR formation, each aircraft has a specific role. According to USAF documents, Sandy 1 is lead pilot, serving as rescue mission commander and on-scene commander responsible for overall command, survivor authentication, and threat suppression. Sandy 2 provides cover and backup leadership. Sandy 3 and 4 focus on the escort mission, protecting the HH-60 rescue helicopters throughout. For nearly five decades, the A-10 has proven ideally suited for the Sandy role. Still, the Air Force is moving forward with plans to retire the A-10 by fiscal 2029. What replaces it in the Sandy role and whether any other platform can replicate what the Warthog and A-10 Sandy qualified pilots bring to the SESAR mission are questions the service has not yet answered. CSAR in a world without warthogs. The Air Force has confirmed there is currently no formal or informal transition underway for the Sandy 1 Rescue Mission Commander role, the on-scene command function of every CSAR operation, to any other specific airframe. Discussions are still ongoing regarding the use of multi-role platforms serving in the A-10's Sandy 01 RMC role, an Air Combat Command spokesperson said. The same applies to Sandy 2, 3, and 4 escort roles, the spokesperson also said. The service's stated transition strategy centers less on the aircraft and more on the expertise of A-10 pilots themselves, suggesting the F-35A as the likely destination platform for Sandy-qualified A-10 pilots. The Air Force is leveraging the extensive experience of its A-10 pilots to ensure a successful transition to other aircraft, the 355th Wing Public Affairs Office said. A-10 pilots bring a wealth of expertise in close air support and combat search and rescue experience, which is invaluable as the A-10 continues to divest and they transition to fifth-generation assets like the F-35. The service also acknowledged that standards for validating successor platform performance in the CSAR mission are a work in progress. The Pentagon is carefully re-examining future close air support and combat search and rescue requirements, the 355th Wing Public Affairs Office said, including how the Air Force will validate the effectiveness of its multi-role fighter fleet in performing all aspects of the CAS mission. CAS stands for Close Air Support. Anyways, no specialized Sandy qualification program for any successor platform, such as the one that existed for the A-10 for many years, has been confirmed to exist or be under development. Lieutenant Colonel Joel Beer, a retired U.S. Air Force Weapons School instructor, pilot, and Sandy 1 instructor with more than 2,500 hours in the A-10, said the service's transition strategy underestimates the complexity of the Sandy mission. No other pilots train to close air support, forward air control, airborne, and combat search and rescue with the ferocity of the A-10 community, Beer said. The challenge, Beer said, is not simply whether the F-35A, F-15E, or F-16 airframes are capable of performing the Sandy mission, but whether the pilot is properly trained for it. A jack-of-all-trades is master of none. Each of the fighter communities trains to a half-dozen more equally complex missions, but CSAR is fundamentally different. It is friendly-centric and combines elements of air superiority and contingency planning at lower speeds and longer durations that fighter platforms do not routinely train to. A-10 versus F-35. In 2016, the Air Force conducted testing to evaluate potential Sandy replacements at the 422nd Test and Evaluation Squadron at Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada. Lieutenant Colonel Joshua Wood, the squadron's commander at the time and an F-35 pilot, was on record expressing skepticism about direct platform comparisons. When you try to have a comparative analysis of a single mission platform like the A-10 against a platform like the F-35, which is fundamentally designed from the ground up to do something completely different, Wood told Combat Aircraft Magazine, as reported by War is Boring in 2016, you run the risk of drawing unrealistic conclusions. Still, Wood described what happened when a former A-10 Sandy 1 instructor, who had recently cross-trained into the F-35, stepped into a lackluster CSAR exercise. No kidding, he shows up and within 5 minutes on station, he's quarterbacked the whole thing, Wood told the magazine. They've rescued their survivor and everyone goes home. Wood attributed the result not to the F-35's capabilities, but to the pilot's CSAR background and Sandy training. I would say 75% is the pilot, he said. Beer said the test results underscored the importance of Sandy training more than the F-35's suitability for the mission. Would the F-35 pilots have stepped in if an F-16 or F-15E CSAR test had been going smoothly? Would they have intervened at all if they weren't both recent A-10 Weapons School graduates and Sandy 1 instructors who had only transferred to the F-35 6 to 9 months earlier? And in the decades since, has anyone in the F-35 community created a single new Sandy qualified for the mission? The answer to all three is no, Beer said. Those F-35 pilots who I personally know and respect never even flew another CSAR in the F-35 outside that test environment, a fact that speaks volumes about how the Air Force has prioritized the Sandy transition plan, he added. A separate 2022 Pentagon test report comparing the F-35A and A-10C obtained through Freedom of Information Act litigation found that F-35A pilots reported a significantly higher workload than A-10C pilots in the forward air control mission, a role closely aligned with the on-scene command demands of Sandy. The report also noted that pilots from both aircraft found that A-10C and F-35A performed more effectively together in contested CSAR than either platform did alone, pointing more toward a combined model than a direct replacement. The test report was completed in February of 2022, nearly 3 years after testing concluded in 2019. The report was finally made public more than 6 years after the test took place, years after Congress had already begun approving the A-10 retirement the test was meant to inform. CSAR community trusts the Warthog. The flight characteristics that define the Sandy mission present their own challenges for potential successor airframes. It's fast enough to stay ahead of the rescue force, but slow enough to scour the grounds for threats to it, and rugged enough to take hits from that threat when necessary, Beer said of the Warthog. The A-10's unique capabilities extend to the rescue helicopter crews the Sandy pilots are tasked with protecting. A-10 Sandys serve HH-60W Jolly Green crews as their rescue escort, ensuring they arrive safely and with all the pertinent information at the downed aircrew, Beer said. Fighters will struggle to expose the small arms and AAA threats from medium altitude while shifting to rotary wing fires sacrifices speed, armor, and communications relay. These shortfalls increase risk to both the jollies and the isolated personnel. The relationship between the A-10 and the accompanying CSAR aircraft is not incidental, Beer said, but rather by design. Calling the HH-60W or HC-130J flawed in the Sandy role is like saying the A-10 is deficient in the Jolly or Crown missions. It's not intended as disrespect, nor is it a design flaw. It's an intentional symbiosis. That's precisely why Sandy, Jolly, and Crown are synonymous with the CSAR missions. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Rudder, commander of the 357th Fighter Squadron at Davis-Monthan, described the relationship between the A-10 community and the rescue force in a recent 355th Wing release. "The trust between the A-10 and the rest of the rescue community is absolute," Rudder said. "They know we will do whatever it takes to protect them while they work to bring our teammates home." On April 3, 2026, the same day A-10s in the Sandy role helped recover Dude 44 Alpha from Iran, the 357th Fighter Squadron graduated its last class of A-10 pilots. In official photo captions, the Air Force called the ceremony the end of an era for A-10 training. Air Combat Command confirmed the 357th is on track to inactivate in fiscal year 2026, although specific timelines were not available. Whether the closure of the 357th marks the ends of the Sandy qualification pipeline entirely, or whether the Air Force plans to establish a similar program for successor platforms remains unclear. Neither the 355th Wing nor Air Combat Command Public Affairs responded specifically to questions about the future of Sandy qualification training by the time of publication. Congressional oversight. The fiscal 2026 National Defense Authorization Act, signed into law in December 2025, was the latest in a series of congressional measures aimed at slowing the A-10's retirement. The measure required the Air Force to deliver a detailed briefing to the House and Senate Armed Services Committees no later than March 31, 2026, on the status of A-10 aircraft inventory and the service's transitional plan for divesting all A-10s prior to fiscal 2029. That deadline has passed. The Secretary of the Air Force Public Affairs Office could not confirm whether the briefing had been delivered. Representative Austin Scott, Republican of Georgia, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, who has pushed to stave off the A-10 retirement, did not immediately respond to questions about whether the committee had received the briefing. It is unclear whether the A-10's recent effectiveness in Operation Epic Fury factors into the Air Force's transition briefing or divestment plans. The NDAA also mandated that the Air Force maintains a minimum inventory of 103 A-10s through September 30, 2026, an amendment authored by Scott, reflecting congressional concerns about the service's transition planning and potential gaps in mission readiness. In a statement provided to Defense News, Scott cited the A-10's recent performance in Iran. "For 50 years, the A-10 Warthog has reliably supported critical military missions. I was proud to lead an amendment in the fiscal year 26 NDAA blocking the premature retirement of A-10s currently in service today. Because the fleet is live, the A-10 is proving why it's critical to our forces, providing air power for freedom and leading the rescue efforts for our airmen that were recently secured from hostile forces in Iran. Scott said, I will continue to work diligently to ensure that our military is properly equipped with the best weapon systems available. Scott pressed the issue at an April 15th AJSC Subcommittee on Readiness hearing, when he asked General John LaMontagne, Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force, what the service was doing to prepare for CSAR operations when the A-10 retires. LaMontagne responded, it'll be a mix of platforms, just like it's been a mix of platforms in the past, with H-860s and overhead folks doing that coordination role that the A-10s have done very well over the years. Scott noted that the HH-60 is a helicopter, the rescue platform, not the Sandy escort. LaMontagne clarified he had understood the question to be about CSAR broadly, rather than the fixed-wing Sandy escort role specifically. Despite these unanswered questions, Lieutenant Colonel Beer offered a potential path forward. If the Air Force proceeds with final A-10 divestment in fiscal year 2027, significant CAS and CSAR capabilities risk being lost due to the compressed timeline. Beer said, extending the remaining A-10 squadrons until a viable replacement is identified offers a logical bridge. Beer noted, the key is selecting an aircraft to deliberately carve out dedicated squadrons with a designed operational capability statement for the Sandy CSAR mission. This must include dedicated training mandate, modeled on the A-10's current Ready Aircrew Program tasking, and unique Air Force specialty codes to prevent diluting that training in the larger multi-role platform community. These actions protect the Sandy community from mission creep and preserve its unwavering commitment to the CSAR covenant, that others may live. Beer also warned that the Air Force cannot afford to ignore the hard-won lessons of the past. As the old military saying goes, lessons are written in blood. Sacrificing over 50 years of hard-won institutional knowledge dooms our future warriors to relearn them the hard way. And that's all for the article, and with that, that's all the time we have. Thank you once again for tuning into this reading of Military Times and to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your host, signing out.